One is filed last is.
We'll go first.
Mr. Pettit's is the one we'll take up. Is any objection to withdrawing the committee substitute where we won't have to go through that in mechanics? I'm trying to shorten the procedure as much as I can. Is the objection to withdrawing the committee substitute? Chair, none, committee substitute is withdrawn. Clerk will read the first amendment to Mr. Pettit's floor substitute.
Mr. Hamilton, move to amend House Bill 280. Substitute, delete on page 2, line 17, the words "other than" and insert "including." And on page 3, line 25, the following: "Such forecasts shall be subject to review by the commission."
Would you let them post it, Mr. Clerk, please?
"By the commission upon..." What was that? "Upon submission of the integrated plan, the commission may accept evidence from any party relevant to the accuracy of the forecast, including but not limited to historical records of the accuracy of previous and similar forecasts by the utility."
Is there objection to adopting the amendment? There is objection to the gentleman move. Gentleman move. What purpose, gentleman 124th rise?
Parliamentary procedure, Mr.
Speaker. Gentleman state his inquiry. It's
parliamentary inquiry, I'm sorry. I got it.
We got it right. Go ahead and ask it, right, please.
Mr. Speaker, isn't it true that the very same study committee that Mr. Pettit mentioned earlier in his deliberations, I was also a member of that study committee?
If you say so.
Isn't it true, Mr. Speaker, that after almost a year's study, that the members of that study committee could not come to a conclusion and no report was issued because they could not come to a conclusion?
That's a matter that the subcommittee members wouldn't know.
No, we didn't do it. By changing the word "including" and taking out "other than," it's the intent of the author of the bill to get the Public Service Commission, is it not true, involved in the activities of this planning up front? If we do not include the word "including" here, we're going to put the Public Service Commission in the process in the middle instead of at the beginning. Is that not true, Mr. Speaker?
That's a matter that each and every member will have to determine for themselves after a careful reading of the entire substitute and the proposed amendment.
Let him.
You true?
No, well, that's... We'll.
We ain't having a debate in society now.
The second amendment, Mr. Speaker. Only thing it's going to do is give the commission in the truth.
Are you going to ask me a question now and make a speech?
That's what I said. Isn't it true? Isn't it true that the Second Amendment, only thing it does is going to give the commission the opportunity to look at additional information other than what utility may bring forth to them and include some of the past experience that the utility may have had in dealing with forecasts? Isn't it true, Mr. Speaker?
That's a matter that each and every member of this body will be able to determine by themselves after a careful reading of the substitute and the proposed amendment. Gentleman from the 19th, what purpose do you rise?
Parliamentary inquiry.
Gentleman state his point.
Mr. Speaker, is it not true that if we adopt the first part of that amendment that we require then the utility to go to the commission to get a certificate before they can even begin planning for future needs of this state?
That also is a matter each and every member will have to determine by themselves after a careful reading of both documents.
Mr. Speaker, further parliamentary inquiry.
Gentleman state his point.
Is it not also true that with regard to the second provision of the Hamilton Amendment, that if that is that presently the commission may consider any information that they want to in determining whether or not to grant that certificate with regard to the integrated resources plan and the application?
That's a matter each and every member will have to determine after reading the documents. Gentleman 124th.
Mr. Speaker, isn't it true that if the gentleman from Cartersville said that the commission already has that authority, then it won't hurt to have a safeguard and we should at least adopt the second part of my amendment?
That's a matter each and every member will have to determine for themselves. Lady from the 76th.
Mr. Speaker, on the amendment, is that delete or on page 2, line 17?
Let me see the thing. It says delete on page 2, line 17. Yes, ma'am.
The word "or"?
The word "other than." And insert "including."
Thank you, sir.
He didn't go to your English class. He didn't put it in quotes. There is objection to adopting the amendment. All those gentlemen from the 46th, what purpose do you rise?
Parliamentary inquiry.
Gentlemen, state his point.
Is it not true that by striking the line other than and including, that you would include the activity of land acquisition in the definition of construction, therefore including any condemnation proceeding being part of the Public Service Commission?
The only answer I can give you to that, if you adopt the gentleman's amendment, you will strike the words other than and add the words including.
Thank you very much.
Gentleman 124th.
What's the procedure of voting on those amendments separately?
It would have been much better if you'd have written them separately. There is a way to do it, though.
Can I ask unanimous consent that they be voted on separately?
No, sir. You need to make a motion that the question be divided and state how you want it devoted, voted on.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Speaker, I move that the amendments be divided.
All right. Be happy to oblige. Vote on the first paragraph, first part of it. That's the striking other than and including. There is objection to that. All those in favor of striking that language or the first part of the amendment, say aye. Those opposed, no.
No
seem to have it. Now the second part, it's there for you to see. All those in favor, vote aye. All those in favor, say aye. Opposed, no.
No
seem to have it. Clerk will read the next amendment.
Mr. Pettit, Mr. Groover. Move to amend House Bill 280, floor substitute, adding on line 24, page 2, after the word utility, the words, or the commission, by deleting the sentence beginning on line 23, page 8, which begins with the word the, and inserting in lieu thereof the following: the commission shall consider lost revenues, if any, changed risks, and an equitable sharing of benefits between the utility and its retail customers.
Is there objection to adopting the amendment? Is there objection? Chair, none amendments adopted. Is there any objection to adopting the floor substitute as amended? Chair, none, the floor substitute as amended is adopted. That makes the other floor substitute out of order now since this one is adopted. Is there any objection to agreeing to Board of Committee's favor to pass the bill? Chair and none, Board of Committee agree to, shall this bill now pass? All those in favor will vote their own machine aye. Those opposed will vote their own machine no. And the clerk will unlock the machine. One machine per person, please. All members voted. All members now voted. If so, the clerk will lock machine. Passes the bill. The ayes are 148. The nays 25. This bill, having received the requisite constitutional majority, is therefore passed. Clerk will read the caption of House Bill 283.
House Bill 283, a bill to be entitled and acted in Chapter 5 relating to ad valorem taxation of property, so as to provide for current use valuation and taxation of bona fide conservation use property and bona fide residential transitional property. This bill has been before the Committee of the House on Ways and Means. Recommend the same to pass for substitute and read the third time.
Ladies and gentlemen of the House, the Chair would suggest to you that you need to remain in your seats. The Chair understand that there may be some discussion about this bill, and it's equally as important as the one you just considered. Checking out a gentleman from Lebanon, Mr. Dover. All members, please take seats and cease all conversation.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ladies and gentlemen, the hour is late. We will do this as thoroughly as we need to, I hope, and we'll answer any questions, but I'd like to move it as expeditiously as possible out of deference to you and the long day you've spent, but I also want to do justice to you about the issue. First off, Mr. Speaker, let me thank thank your committee on Ways and Means. If all the other chairs in the House have as hard-working committees as I do, and my former committee also, you're lucky folks, because my members have spent hours that you other folks would, I know, can appreciate. But this is the 24th draft of this bill. Number 24. All right, first off, let me say two or three preliminary things, and then I'm going to quickly go through the bill and answer your questions. Remember under Amendment 3 that the people of Georgia have directed us to create three unique concepts. Well, the people of Georgia themselves have created three unique types of taxation policy by a constitutional amendment. Our job has been to try to implement that legislation, and to say the least, it has been a difficult, difficult process. We have had so many varying groups involved in this that I feel good that the general public, that people of Georgia and all the interests involved have had an opportunity to be in the process. If you will walk through the bill with me, I'll go through first and then I'll answer your questions, please. Can you hear me? I don't dare touch this thing. Now, can you hear me all right? I think maybe I went too far. Good. Now, can you hear me all right? All right. Thank you. If you would allow me to go through the bill, please, and remember, if you will, that these three concepts, that being a covenant to authorize current use valuation on genuine agricultural property, a current use covenant on residential transitional property, and thirdly, the taxation of timber as a severed material or as logs rather than a class of ad valorem property standing on the soil. Let's go through the bill, if we may, please, and then we'll answer questions. I'm sure each of you had your synopsis over the weekend and thoroughly studied that, so hopefully that'll solve most of your problems. Page 2, if you'll begin looking online, I'm going to do this fairly quickly. So page 2, line 26, we begin with the definitions. That initial section really are the new definitions of current use property. If you'll also look then on page 3, beginning on line 16 through line 6 on page 7, you will find language that is in the existing law. Correction, line 16 on page 7, which is present law as it deals to fair market value. Now remember, if a private citizen does not choose current use valuation covenants in those two categories, then of course their property would continue to be valued at fair market value.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Could the chair ask you a question?
You certainly may, sir.
On the committee substitute,
yes,
you
sir.
Are discussing LC 18-4224S.
Sir, we're dealing with LC 18-4224 Sierra, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Which is a committee substitute from the Ways and Means Committee. If you'll look, please, on page 8. Page 8, we have amendments from several members of the committee to hopefully allay to a great extent some of the fears that some of our local officials have with a possible difficulty with the legislation as it deals to a frozen assessment and initially a frozen millage rate also under these covenants. We do have two amendments from the committee that I'll present to the clerk and ask you to consider at the proper time. They will change the language on page 8 to free the millage so that only the assessed value of the property would remain constant for the 10-year period of a covenant. This is one of the areas where the commissioners' associations have expressed the greatest concern. We contend at this point that if a person is willing to covenant his or her property for a 10-year period of time and thereby surrender to a great extent their private property rights. Now that's a unique thought, it's a unique idea, but that's in fact what you're doing if you sign a covenant. And these covenants are very carefully structured and very strictly enforced by a double tax recapture if you choose to go into covenant. I don't have the same fear that some of our other people do around the state as far as the Commissioners Association and Municipal Association and the School Boards Association, based on the history of what happened under preferential assessment. The predecessor to this legislation did not, in fact, create any significant tax drain or any significant tax shift in rural Georgia. That's a matter of fact already. But out of deference and consideration to the Commissioners Association, the Municipal Association, and the School Boards Association, several of us in the committee are offering to you amendments that would, in fact, release the millage rate so that the millage rate on the current use covenants could fluctuate and certainly help allay some of the fears, I hope. And remember to also, ladies and gentlemen, next year is hopefully all of us will be alive and well and here. And let me assure you that there's no intent of the Ways and Means Committee to raid local treasuries. But I also want to share something with you that's a very basic philosophical thing with me, and that is that the revenue of Georgia, my committee get tired of hearing me say this, the revenue of Georgia doesn't belong to this General Assembly. The revenue of Georgia does not belong to county commissioners. The revenue of Georgia does not belong to municipal fathers. It belongs to the folks. All right, and let's don't lose sight of that principle. It belongs to the people. And the best tax relief that I know of is what you don't take out of a person's pocket. Now think about the policy. Let me give this to the clerk. Excuse me just one moment. Also, the Second Amendment would narrow down the qualifying factors for the second class of property, which is the residential transitional, to further prevent abuse of this particular concept. The concept of residential transitional would be narrowed to say that if a person or persons who are single family residential owners are willing to sign a covenant to retain their property as residential property, owner occupied, and they are in a rapidly changing area, and they can show that proximity to a development would in fact, or had already in fact, caused their property values to tremendously increase over a recent period of time, then they could qualify to go into a residential transitional covenant on 5 acres of property or less. Proceeding then, please, if we will, on page 9 to tell you what bona fide conservation property is. Page 9, line 29 says bona fide conservation use property is not more than 2,000 acres tangible real property, which is in good faith production, that is production of food and fiber. We are in no way attempting here to give development a shelter. We're trying to protect genuine owner-occupied single-family farms that are producing food, fiber. It's amazing to me that unfortunately a lot of our children seem to have the idea that meat's produced in plastic trays and eggs come in styrofoam cartons, but a lot of us realize that somebody out in the real world's got to be producing those with honest-to-goodness farms. Okay, proceeding on page 10, several of the elements that can be included in the covenant, anything permanently affixed. There was some great deal of discussion in our committee as to whether or not a chicken house, and you folks from Hall County especially can understand this, but whether or not a chicken house was a part of a chicken farm. Well, I certainly contend you can't grow chickens on bare dirt. So the list on page 10 would give you the facilities that are included or are eligible to be included in the current use in the conservation use covenant, but the residents certainly will not be included. Your residents would not be qualified as far as a conservation use covenant. Further on page 11, Bill, get me some, oh, Bobby's got it. Bless you, sir. Thank you. Page 11, we see beginning on line 9, several permissive factors that also may be contributed, may be contributory to designation as conservation use. But line 24, page 11, you have mandatory provisions, those things that must be present on that real estate before it could be qualified, which include harvesting, storing, etc. You can read, all of you, far better than I can. Beginning on page 12, we have an additional class of property that at the discretion of the owner, now remember that, at the discretion of the owner, environmentally sensitive areas can in fact qualify under conservation use covenants. We had Mr. Rehise, thank you, sir. We had Mr. Rehise from EPD come and talk to the committee, and after consultation with him, we changed the language significantly to adjust it to his reservations, and now, contrary to the articles in the press, is such that the entire state certainly does not qualify. Only a very, very small portion of the state would qualify under environmentally sensitive areas, but you're welcome to please look at those and peruse them as we go along. Page 13, line 31, at least one half of the acreage would have to be in the qualifying parameters before it could have a covenant. Page 14, line 8, designating 10 acres or less, specifying 10 acres or less of property that could still qualify as a farm, because we have a few chicken farms in the mountains that are less than 10 acres, but the tax assessor could request additional corroborating evidence if necessary before that covenant would be signed. Farther down on the page in 14, only 2,000 acres in the aggregate. And as far as residential transitional covenants, no more than 5 acres for any single individual. Page 15, there is a 10-year covenant required. Initially, we looked at the possibility of a sliding covenant, but to, again, as to help allay the fears of Commissioners Association and Municipal Association and others, we decided to lock down on a 10-year covenant. Page 15, the bottom of the page, subparagraph C, a person, some of our row cropping friends from South Georgia pointed out that occasionally you have what we love to playfully call executive farmers who live in town, but they got 3 or 4 little patches out in the country. They can still have a split farm, but it could not aggregate to more than 2,000 acres. Also, page 16, that property can be located in more than one county. Farther down on page 16, line 15, you can have either a conservation use covenant or a preferential assessment covenant, but you can't be in both. All right, we're not going to have folks double dipping. Page 18 tells, subparagraph F tells when you would file for a covenant. Farther down on 18, page 31, line 31, you have the same appeal rights here that you would have under fair market valuation, simply because if for some reason you breached your covenant, then, and you came back under the fair market provisions of the law, you'd have the same right to appeal whatever valuation was placed on your property there that you would have, that any other taxpayer should have. Page 19, I think here's something that I want you to please look at carefully. Page 19, line 11. Excuse me.
Does the gentleman yield for questions?
Mr. Speaker, I'd rather go through right quick and then
gentleman
I'll come back
prefer to wait
any
until
of
them
the best way I can.
He's finished his remarks.
Page 19, line 11. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a double penalty. Now take this for what it is. I contend that people will not enter these covenants frivolously, particularly those people who are genuinely involved in the production of food and fabric. It says that if you breach that covenant any time in the life of the covenant, then you're going to pay twice, you're going to pay a double whammy. You're going to pay twice the tax advantage that you've had from that. So I still believe people are not going to enter these covenants frivolously. All right, on page 20, we begin with a series of reasons why the covenant is not breached under certain conditions. And I'll give you an example and we'll move on. Primarily an example that if a person were to deed to his or her heirs a 5-acre tract or less for their own use, and that means the person to the fourth degree of civil reckoning, then that would not, if it's for to either be continued in its use or for a residential use for that child, that would not be a breach of the covenant. We're trying to protect that also. Page 21 also further defines the conditions under which the covenant would not be breached. Page 22, if for some reason the property had to have had mineral exploration, if it were condemned under right of eminent domain, etc., these would not automatically breach the covenant. Page 24, for those of you that deal in real estate, line 19 on page 24 would guarantee that public access to these covenants so that people doing title search, etc., could find them and there wouldn't be any problem with title insurance, etc. So we're thinking about you folks before the bar. Farther down, page 24, line 31, several of us have had a tremendous amount of concern recently, I know all of you have really, about the massive amount of paperwork that's generated in this on this hill inclusively. So we have required that the report on the impact of these covenants would be submitted to the committees that are directly concerned with that, one report per committee, and make them available to the membership and to you rather than having all these massive, expensive documents come at $3 and $4 a piece to your residents. We're trying to help you and all of us save a little of the people's money. All right, beginning on page 25, then we look very quickly at the remaining class of property for us to be concerned about under Amendment 3, and that's the taxation of timber. I'm going to hit this quick and fast. Apparently, most of the people in the industry are well pleased after all these many drafts at the manner in which we have determined to offer to you, if you'll agree with us, for them to be taxed on their timber. Remember, please, this. Conservation use covenants, transitional residential covenants, are on the dirt. They're on the soil. But the third class, the taxation of timber, is to tax trees once they're sold for logs or once they become logs. The bill continues to very clearly designate the method of collection, who is responsible for paying either on a what we call a lump sum sale of timber, and in the mountains we say that's a boundary sale. If you sell a man all the timber standing on 20 acres of land and you don't scale that, that's a lump sum sale or a boundary sale. We are careful to delineate the conditions under which the taxes are paid, by whom. Then if you have a unit price sale, that is if you sell pulpwood by the unit or by the pound, etc., then we make provisions for that. Also, for those of us who are what we call peckerwood sawmillers in the mountains, who cut our own timber and saw it and sell it ourselves, there's a provision in there for us. We have to pay ourselves at the time it's harvested. So either way, if you cut timber, you're going to pay tax on the timber when it becomes logs and not standing on the land as ad valorem property. You all remember that the Revenue Commissioner's Office had issued regulation recently saying that timber would be declared, would be considered as ad valorem tax and taxed as such as a part of the real estate. But we contend that that is not the case, and we recommend to you, and the people have apparently agreed, obviously they have agreed, that by Amendment 3 that should be taxed as a long-term crop rather than as an ad valorem property. The last part of the bill provides something we call truth in taxation, to say to local officials that if in fact, and this is another one of the sticky points now, and I'm going to tell you what's going on. It says that if you, for any reason, at the local level, have to increase taxes, and we know that happens pretty regularly, then you must tell your constituency what you've done in over a five-year history. I'm going to tell you, I think a point of negotiation at this juncture. The school boards are concerned about this tremendously, and that's why you've gotten your negative feedback from the School Boards Association. This year alone, as a result of QBE, and I have to plead guilty right here in the presence of two or three real good attorneys up front and a lot of folks I respect and love, I helped write it, and I told you at the time in 1985 it wasn't perfect. Well, some aspects of it are coming home to haunt us. And the School Superintendents Association, we'll let them share their part of the burden now. They asked us to pass it. We passed it unanimously. Now everybody's got to live with it at this point. But still, the required local effort, what is the new term, local fair share? I can't remember all these initials and all this stuff, but anyhow, there's going to be a tremendous increase this very year because of a downturn in state revenue on the local fair share. And it's going to scare you when I tell you how much it is. It's going to cost local school boards over the entire state $55 million additional dollars. And if you go to a school board meeting and you tell folks you got what you got to do, then that can be extremely embarrassing. And therefore, I think there's probably some room in this language on the truth and taxation section to hopefully get the school boards and our constituents together in a way so that nobody would be embarrassed. I mean, we all are taxpayers, and we've all got to share both the responsibility of government as well as whatever has to be done. And sometimes we have to make decisions that aren't popular very frequently. So with that, Mr. Speaker, I'll be glad to answer questions because I know we're tired and I know it's late. And so I'm here standing at your pleasure. Thank you.
The gentleman from 73rd, Mr. Dunn.
Yes, sir.
Gentlemen, well, I have one question. First of all, I'd like to compliment you on the job you did getting such a huge bill out. But like most tax measures, it's probably more complicated than it needs to be.
Yes, sir, it is.
My question deals with the residential, transitional residential property. And I understand in talking about preferential agricultural property where somebody might have a job in town and have a little piece of ground they're farming on a little bit but not making income for, that there might be a need to sign a covenant as well as historical property. But from the residential standpoint, tax assessors can certainly tell if somebody's living and occupying a house. And my question is, why do we want to make folks that are living and occupying in the home sign a covenant just because they happen to live by a shopping center in a transitional area? I think that status is obvious from the use of the property. And again, the whole idea of legislation I've offered in the past that dealt with this question is to prevent the taxing authorities from taxing people off their property simply because somebody else may use it for better use.
Yes, sir. I can appreciate that because there are lots of people in transitional areas, particularly in Representative Jameson, my area, Mr. Barnett's area, and the northeastern corridor from the metro area who are in that rapidly transcending area into second homes, et cetera. The reason for the covenant, of course, is to get a good faith agreement between the property owner and the tax assessors and the local officials to say that if we're going to give you a tax break, then we need to make sure that you're not going to, as much as possible, gentlemen, that you're not going to capitalize on that until such time as your covenant is terminated. Yes, sir.
Gentlemen, suspend. Ladies and gentlemen, we have three amendments, two of them long enough to require printing, and they're distributing at this very moment over on this side, and we've asked some to bring some to this side. So if you will be prepared to read those, because some of them are about three pages long. Now, is the gentleman yield, gentleman 73rd?
Yes, Mr. Speaker.
Follow-up question, and again, I'm not trying to belabor this point, but if I am living in a transitional home as my residence and sign a covenant, as I understand the bill, for 10 years. Within that 10-year period, I sell my property. I've got to pay a penalty. Is that correct?
You're going to pay a big penalty.
But does not the property, when I sell it, go on the rolls as commercial property? If I'm living in a house that happens to be in a transitional neighborhood and I sell my property, does not at the time of sale, when it goes for that higher use, would it not go on the books at that time at the greater value as justified by the sales price and change of use? Why, as a homeowner, should I be punished by having to pay a penalty simply because I want to move somewhere at that period of time? Again, in the agricultural area, I understand the distinction. And in the historical property, I understand the distinction. But as a resident, I still find it hard to distinguish or find it difficult to say why we ought to punish those folks that are living in a house as their residence, and we're talking about personal residence, not second homes or anything else. It's obvious for the local tax people to understand that they're living there and that's where the home is. It just seems to me that that is a little harsh to put that, isn't it true? It just seems a little harsh to put that kind of penalty on a homeowner.
Jim from 73rd, that's strictly still a choice of the individual taxpayer to make that election, to go into a covenant in lieu of a tax shelter at that point, because that same property might be worth $1 million an acre and they may be assessed on it at $10,000 an acre. So that's it. Really, it's just a decision of the property owner.
Jim, you yield, Jim, 21st. Jim, yield to Mr.
Council,
Wilder.
Let me make one more statement, Mr. Speaker. Gentleman from 73rd, Mr. Dunn, H.R. 836, that point. But no one's going to coerce you into determining whether you're going to go into a residential covenant or not. You can sell it to Mr. Walton or, you know, whomever.
Gentlemen, suspend. Please take your conferences to the ante room, those along the wall over there. Gentlemen, continue.
Isn't it true that this artificial value that you're talking about, that property only might possibly assume the value of the adjacent property only in the event that that property is zoned properly?
You're right, sir.
So if I want to sit on my residentially zoned property from now till doomsday, do I still have to make this decision even though that property is not rezoned to the adjacent zoning?
No, sir. In no point do you ever have to make that decision. It's an option that you could consider if you chose in the best interest of your occupancy of that residence.
Okay, further question?
All right, sir.
On page 4, on line 18, where it talks about the first 8 years, it seems to me when you get down to line 25, we're saying that the value of the property for the next 8 years is what it was as of that first point in time.
Sir, that language is an existing law. The section you're referring to now is an existing law as it deals with the preferential assessment, which the General Assembly passed several years ago. That's already existing law. It has nothing to do with the concept of conservation use. That's present law.
As
okay, it
deals
with preferential assessment.
Let's try page 6 then.
All right, sir.
Line
Just
3.
Just pick out one.
Pardon?
Just pick out one.
Just pick out one.
Right.
How about page 6, line 3?
You got it.
What about the money that would have or should have been collected when it comes to talking about this evaluation? What do you do in a case like that? If the county was depending on that money and then this has changed and that revenue flow is not coming in, wouldn't the county realize a loss in revenue at this point in time?
Now, if I'm reading the section you're referring to, are you referring to timber?
Yes.
Well, sir, from a practical standpoint, the taxation on the timber is simply being deferred till the cutting cycles begin. And at that point, timber would be, once it becomes logs, would be valued at 100% of its fair market value. And so any impact on the digest, any temporary impact would certainly level itself out in a very short period of time. Most of the metropolitan areas would have very little involvement in the timber taxation part. Yes, sir.
Okay, on page 8. Line 1, this C, paragraph C2, this is new language here?
Look at your printed amendment, please, sir. The printed amendments that the clerk's office have handed out changed that language significantly to hopefully reduce some of the reservations that the local officials have had as far as unfreezing the millage rate.
Okay. On the fiscal note that we had that came with this bill, where the last paragraph says the impact cannot be determined relative to, is it right to say that there are going to be counties in the rural parts of the state that could lose a revenue income stream by changing the timber?
Yes, sir. That's true on a temporary basis. But if it's happens in a reduction of revenue up to 20% of their digest, then the people who have had timber harvested would have to pro rata go back and supplement the dirt with the timber tax to help cushion that impact.
The 20% you're talking about then is on page 36 when you were...
I don't recall
exactly.
You mentioned
some particular language,
but
on page 36 where it talks about the 20% difference?
Yes, sir.
So that county will not be stuck with that 20% deficit. There'll be somebody else that the timber
well,
will
the
come
folks,
around. Try to.
Let me see if I can put it in language I can understand, sir.
Me too.
Myself. If there's more than a 20% reduction in the local digest because of the timber coming off, then the folks who had timber cut and benefit from the sale of that timber have to go back and supplement the dirt it came from.
So they would have...
And the big hog will pay the big bite.
Okay. So it'll be kind of down on a pro rata share to try to make up towards that 20%.
Yes, sir, that's true.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. I appreciate your questions.
Gentlemen, suspend. We have about 6 conferences on the floor. Chair, respectfully ask that you carry them to the ante rooms. Now, gentlemen, you're the gentleman from Fulton, Dr. Holmes.
Yes, sir. Where is
on your
here
own.
We are. All right. Very
okay.
good, sir.
I've got a couple questions, Mr.
All
Chairman.
Right,
first, I, too, am concerned about the fact that the state auditor was unable to assess the fiscal impact.
Yes, sir.
And my first question relates to what happens to the local tax digest if, in fact, the timber tax, in fact, reduces the amount only 19%. Is there any similar kind of contribution which kicks in as occurs with the 20%?
No, sir. There's not.
So that if it's 19%, then there's in effect a net loss of 19%?
No, sir. The burden would be spread over the entire tax digest.
Well, but the timber growers would not have to pay their share, would they? Because there would be no taxation upon their products until such time as they're cut and sold, right?
Yes, sir. That's true. So, but they'll certainly pay a goodly fair share when they cut those trees.
So would it be your estimation, and this is based on the fact that the auditor says they didn't know what would be the effect, that there would probably be an ad valorem tax increase among homeowners in the counties which have less than 20% increase?
That certainly is a possibility. But back to what I said earlier in my presentation, under the predecessor to this very concept, the so-called preferential assessment, that did not occur.
Okay.
We have very good data from the university to show that there was not a land office rush, Mr. Chairman, to get into preferential assessments. Several of us in this room probably, I would say there's probably a greater number of people in this room who took those preferential assessment covenants because we knew about them and tried to publish it to our local people. But I believe in the first several years in my home county, there were 74 people out of 14 or 1,500 parcels that actually took advantage of that tax shield.
Okay.
I don't foresee a massive rush to do this.
I guess my concern is not so much that, it is the fact that you would in fact have a tax shift. Let's say if 15% of the tax digest were attributable to timber tax or tax on land which grew timber. And no longer would that 15% assessment go into the local treasury for the county or the county school board or whatever. Would not that 15% then have to be shifted to maintain the same budget balance over to the homeowners?
Yes, sir, it would. But at the same time, once as I answered the former question, as the cycles of harvest come into play, then that will play itself out. Those same folks who originally had the advantage of the shift, temporary shift off of timber, would be picking up an additional share of it coming back in the other side.
Okay.
So everybody gets a chance to help support schools.
Well, I have a question related to that.
Yes, sir.
As we know, QBE mandates a minimum local effort in terms of funding of local schools.
Yes, sir.
And my concern is a reduction or taking off of the rolls such property as would be done under this particular timber tax, would that also be construed, or have you heard from State Department, as in fact a reduction in the local effort as relates to the support of the schools?
It could be if the impact is that great, but now remember there are only a very small number of counties in Georgia that have such a tremendous amount of their local tax revenue based on timber.
Okay.
We're not talking about 159 counties, Mr. Chairman. We're talking about a small number of counties whose tax base is so largely already wrapped up in standing timber.
Okay, I understand that. One last question. I guess my concern relates to the fact that if the local effort of the local tax digest of schools are diminished, would this not in fact require a greater state effort in the sense that educational funds would have to flow more into those schools in these small number of areas that you required, those funds of which for the most part would come from urban or metropolitan areas?
That is a possibility, but under QBE, Mr. Chairman, which you very wisely have right, that was part of the concept there, that we would, under the Whitfield County case, try to sort of let all of us help educate each other's children.
I agree, yes, Mr. Chairman, but isn't it further true that we're pleased to do our fair share, but if in fact this bill requires us to do more than our fair share, it would be an undue burden on the urban areas?
Yes, sir. I understand that, and I respect your perspective, and then I'm going to look at one other side of the issue quickly, and that is that when we altered hotel-motel taxes, special taxing districts, and all kind of things that we do for you, our beloved urban colleagues, we're simply asking a little reciprocity.
But isn't it true that those taxes are imposed upon those of us who live in here in the district when we have special tax districts and things of that nature?
Yes, sir, that's true, but there are not a whole lot of hotels down in Charlton County.
Gentlemen, suspend.
Yes, sir.
Got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 conferences on the floor. 6. Please take them to the ante room, ladies and gentlemen. The hour's getting late. I have a number of inquiries of the gentleman in the well. I have gentlemen from Mr. Childers, Mr. Jackson, Mr. Twiggs, Ms. Williams, Mr. Ray. As a gentleman, yield to the gentleman from the 15th on your extreme left, Mr.
Yes,
Childers.
Yes, sir, Mr. Speaker. Be
please
glad
give him your attention, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
We passed a few years ago a covenant that gave anyone that had 2,000 acres a 25% reduction on their property. Is that still intact?
Yes, sir, it is intact.
And so this is an additional
tax break?
No,
sir, you can't have both. We're going to give you a one-time opportunity under this legislation, if it becomes law, to choose if you want to stay in the preferential assessment covenant or if you want to change to a conservation use covenant, but you can't be in both.
Okay, presently they get a 25% reduction up to 2,000.
Yes.
So they can still keep that.
As long as they stay in that covenant, don't breach it.
As long as they stay in that covenant.
Yes, sir.
Or they have a second choice, they can just pay the amount of taxes that they're paying this current year for the next 10 years under a separate covenant. Is that right?
No, sir. You'd have to choose to go from the preferential assessment to current use valuation. You can't be in both systems at the same time. But you can change from one to the other without a breach of the covenant.
Explain me what kind of a break a farmer with 200 acres would get if he chose to go in a covenant to leave his property as a farm for the next 10 years.
All right, sir. First off, under the existing preferential assessment, he or she has been guaranteed a 25% reduction from 40% of their market value to 30 under preferential assessment. That's for the life of the covenant. But if that same farmer chose to go into a current use covenant, then the determination of current use value by all the parameters in this bill and a covenant agreed upon by the homeowner, by the farmer, by the local tax assessors, under regulations from the Revenue Commission would determine at that point what advantage he or she would have. Gentlemen, from the 15th, if a farmer is presently farming 200 acres in South Georgia, his current use is agriculture. He's not likely to change his use, and I don't foresee any tremendous shift in taxes at that point because most of his neighbors are farming also. And his current use valuation at the beginning of the covenant would be for agricultural purposes.
Is the gentleman yield to the gentleman from the 9th, Mr. Jackson?
Yes, sir. I'd be glad to.
Mr. Chairman, I guess Hall County is in a very unique position. It's, isn't it true, it's got the second number most farms in the state and the county.
Yes,
at
sir.
At the same time in transitional area on kind of Lake
Yes,
near.
Sir.
It, what worries me is the fact that you addressed one of them in raising the millage rate, but you're going to allow farm districts to go in at assessed value of use, which hypothetically would say $500 an acre.
Yes, sir.
And during a 10-year period, my home and my land and my home is going to go up 100%.
Yes, sir.
But you're going to leave the farms at $500 an acre for 10 years. Is that what you're doing?
As the bill's presently written, yes, sir.
All right, let me ask you some more.
All right, sir.
Bona fide conservation use property on page 9 lists as 2,000 acres tangible property of a single owner.
Yes, sir.
Most timber leases are net leases, aren't they, where the timber company pays the taxes?
That just depends on, there's so many variations, Jim, from the 9th that they're myriad. But now remember one thing, your timber lease has nothing to do with a conservation use covenant.
No, sir, I was getting around to,
right,
if I'm a owner of 2,000 acres,
yes, sir,
and I qualify under this, then I lease it to the timber companies under this proposition that's here today, would they be able, under a net lease, be able to take advantage of lower taxes, possibly on 3 or 4 million acres throughout
the
state?
Sir. Absolutely, no way, no way.
Because you tell me then, if I've got at least to a timber company, if my 2,000 acres in my name, and they've got a net lease where they pay the taxes, that they'll still have to pay the higher taxes rather than lower taxes.
They can't qualify under the parameters of this legislation, gentlemen, from that, they can't qualify because they are not an individual, nor are they a family farm corporation. We've been very careful about that.
All right, on page 25.
All right, sir.
Under subsection B, on line 28, continued language says, separate and apart from underlying land and shall not include the simultaneous sale of a tract of land and the timber thereof, their own.
Would this quote me the line again, Mr. Jackson.
On line 28 on page 25.
Line 28, page
25.
Page 25, all right,
yes,
sir. I'm with you.
28 through 30.
All right, sir.
Would this, I'm worried that this language would allow an owner to sell the land and the standing timber to a timber company, and then the timber company cut and use the timber in its operation without the tax being triggered.
No, sir. There's a provision also says that if the land were sold with the timber standing on it, the tax would be due at the time of harvest. We're going to get it. In the constitutional amendment, it says sale or harvest. Is that not correct, counsel? The original amendment says sale or harvest. So, gentlemen from the 9th, we're going to get the tax on the timber one way or the other. I mean, I think we got it pretty closely locked down.
Okay, final question.
All right.
On the gentleman from Atlanta. Under the equalization grant formula, as I understand it, a county's tax digest is divided by the statewide digest to come up with your share. An adjusted formula.
Right.
If in Hall County we took away 20% of the taxes, then the remainder of the state more than likely would include out of the equalization grant. We would get more money for equalization grant, thus lowering other people's equalization grant money. Isn't that true?
That's possible. I don't think it's likely to happen as fast as the values are changing in your county.
Chairman, you'll jump the fourth. Mr.
Yes,
Twiggs, I'll get to the lady from the 48th.
Well,
to Mr.
Speaker,
Ray.
Mr. Speaker, do I have to yield to my mountain colleague?
No, sir, you don't. I don't imagine.
Hey, I heard him say under his breath, I better. Yes, sir, I will yield.
Mr. Dover, if I had 12 acres and I put it under your covenant.
Under your covenant, sir.
And it's not mine, sir. Sold it in 5 years. And I pulled a Hank Snow and moved to North Carolina. How are you going to collect that double whammy?
Well, I suspect before you would get, somebody's going to pay it who owns that before they record another deed, gentleman from the fourth.
You mean you're putting this on the buyer,
correct? No, sir, we got a lien that would be on the property itself. Now, if you absconded to North Carolina with that person's money and didn't pay the taxes, then I would suspect you would be at some legal remedy before the court and responsible for that person for civil damages.
Well, you could bring me back to Georgia, is that what you're saying?
He could get you back in Georgia.
During the summer when we passed this bill, it was under the impression that to pass the constitutional amendment, my people were under the impression that this would help them with their small farms, their small homes, and now we're putting covenants on mountaintops and flowers that are endangered and wetlands and historical sites and stuff like that and taking the taxes off of them. Looks to me like that would raise the
I can't hear you.
This would raise the taxes on your small homes and small farms. Is this not correct?
That's potential, sir, but under preferential assessment, that kind of thing hasn't happened in the past.
Gentlemen, you're the lady from the 48th on your left, Mrs. Williams.
Be glad to, sir.
My friend from the mountains, parliamentary inquiry.
Yes, ma'am.
I hate to belabor this point about the equalization grants, but I feel like I have to bring up the point.
Sure.
Suppose these lands are taken off the tax rolls or pay a smaller amount.
Yes, ma'am.
And then the intra-county problem becomes very critical and they have to raise the millage on the other landowners in that county.
Yes, ma'am.
Then if they have a problem down the road and they have to come back to us, do you foresee that my county will suffer even more, DeKalb County, in the equalization grant and be further penalized on the amount of money they send to the state? Do you foresee that?
I don't foresee that based on the small number of people that have been involved in these covenants in the past. I assure you, at least for one more session, if God lets me live and the Speaker lets me continue and my folks in the Ways and Means Committee, we'll try to rectify any serious things that come out of this. But we've got a mandate from the people by the amendment to attempt to provide the enabling legislation. And ladies from DeKalb, it ain't perfect, but we'll keep working on it.
Gentlemen, you'll jump 98, Mr. Ray.
Be glad to, Mr. Speaker.
Gentlemen, well, yield.
Yes, sir.
Is it not true that in the past that about three-fourths of counties or more, the majority of counties, hadn't taxed timber at all anyway?
Say again, sir. Let me hear you.
Is it not true that majority of the counties in the state of Georgia hadn't been taxing timber anyway?
That's exactly right.
And then is it not true that now that they're going to be getting taxed they never got before?
Hypothetically, that is true, and I think from a practical standpoint, that's also true.
And is it not also true that this won't have any effect on the land that this timber is standing on? The land would still be taxed as any other land that didn't have timber on it.
Yes, sir, unless it's in a conservation use covenant separately from the timber.
Now, in these transitional areas where a person had a home and they built a shopping center, an interchange or something, That covert was designed, is it not true, to protect that person and force them not to have to move, rather than the covert was put there where a speculator couldn't go in there and buy that property and get the exemptions. That's the reason Mr. Dunn's question about why is it a penalty for getting out of that covert. Isn't that the reason?
Yes, sir.
Is it not also true that it won't be as many people getting in this program as you may think, because unless you're in one of those areas and in the near areas, even farmland would stay the same until the tax go up, but if they didn't enter that covert, it wouldn't be much need unless they were near a location where the property was good getting higher anyway,
yes,
more expensive.
You're absolutely correct. I appreciate
Thank you, Mayor.
I have three inquiries, Mr. Dover.
I sure be glad to take
Gentlemen
them, Mr. Speaker.
From the 77th, Mr. Ware, on your right.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
To the gentleman from the 11th, if you live in a county where they tax the value of the land and the timber together, what happens when this law goes into effect? Do they roll, say this, the values are divided half and half?
Well, so then the timber would be classified as standing timber and no longer can be taxed under Amendment 3, but still would have to be listed for potential taxing at the time it's severed or becomes logs.
Whose responsibility is that? Is that the landowner's?
Your local tax assessor, sir.
Your local tax assessor. Well, what is the earliest time that the latest time that you could cut timber that you now own, standing timber, and not be subject?
Yes, sir. I believe January 1, 1992. Is that correct, counsel? December 31, 1991. My attorney has corrected me by 24 hours, or really by 1 minute, Mr. Chairman. You'll have this year to go ahead and do whatever planning you have before the timber tax takes effect.
That answers my other questions same time. Thank you.
Yes, sir. You're welcome.
Chairman Yield, the gentleman from 124th on your extreme left, Mr. Hamilton.
Yes, sir. Be glad to.
I know this is a very complicated issue that you're dealing with, and I commend you. I want to particularly commend you, though, on the language on page 42 dealing with what some of us have been working on for several years, which is known as the truth and taxation provision. I commend you for putting that language in the bill.
Thank you, sir, and you can thank Legislative Council. They had some serious involvement in that.
Gentlemen, you're the gentleman from the 74th, Mr. Dobbs, and I get the gentleman from 144th.
Be glad to.
To my friends from the mountains. On
yes,
page
sir.
12, you've got some language in there about environmentally sensitive areas that are 1,000 feet or more above lowest elevation.
Yes, sir.
How high is your farm?
How high is my farm? My farm would be included, yes, sir. My farm is, one part of it is 1,600 feet above sea level, and one part of it's 20, the other part, the mountain, I think, is 26. And I believe your friend from the 4th there is prompting you, is he not?
Jim Neal, Jim 144.
Well, Speaker, may I make a quick comment there? That piece that's 2,600 feet up just holds the world together.
Jim from the 144th, Mr. Royal.
Yes, sir.
Gentleman Yield.
Yes, sir, I do.
Is it not true that Georgia is the only state out of 12 southeastern states that does not have a current use valuation in place?
You're right, sir.
Is it not further true that Amendment 3 dealt with the timber taxation in its entirety other than the methods of collecting it? So regardless of what we do in here, timber will be exempted except upon its sale or harvest.
That is true, sir.
Is it further true that this summer there was a complete media blitz on Amendment 3 and that the general public was informed that there were some risk, and 62% of the people decided that it was worth that risk to pass this for conservation use?
Yes, sir. You're absolutely and eminently correct, as always. You see why I have good junior officers?
Mr. Dover, can the chair ask you a question?
You certainly may, Mr. Speaker.
You have two amendments. One has been printed and passed out. Have you covered that?
Yes, sir, I have. That simply unfreezes the millage rate, which is one of the big concerns that the county commissioners and the municipal association had. The other one is much briefer. And the second amendment, Mr. Speaker, would further narrow the parameters under which a person could enter a residential transitional covenant by simply saying that you would have to show that, in fact, your property's value had tremendously increased in the recent past as a result of development adjacent or nearby. Mr. Speaker, if you have any more questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
I have no other inquiry.
All right, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, as I've said before on some pieces of legislation, this is not perfect, but it's a good faith effort. I appreciate your patience, certainly staying here at this late hour. I commend this bill to you in good faith, and we will continue working on the process. Thank you so very much, and good day. Vote for it, if you will.
Mr. Stancil on the floor.
He withdrew his amendment.
He's withdrawn. Any objection to the previous question being ordered? Any objection to the previous question being ordered? Chair, none. Previous questions ordered. Clerk will read the First Amendment.
Mr. Dover and others offer the following amendment. Amend the Committee on Ways and Means substitute to House Bill 283 by striking from lines 4 and 5 of page 15 the following. Increased assessments directly attributable to development by inserting after use on line 8 of page 15 the following. To qualify as residential transitional property, the valuation must reflect a change in value attributable to such property's proximity to or location in a transitional area.
Is there objection to adopting the amendment? Chair has none. Amendments adopted. The gentleman from the 73rd, what purpose does the gentleman rise?
Mr. Chairman, in light of the fact that the amendments have been printed and distributed, I'd move that we dispense with the reading of the additional amendments that are printed.
We'll do that because it's a long amendment. Gentleman 49th, what purpose does the gentleman rise?
I ask to be exempted from this vote under Rule 134 for a personal conflict of interest.
Gentleman 49th states that he has a conflict of interest, asked to be excused from voting. Chair recognizes his request. Is there anyone else? Same thing, Jim. Mr. Garland and gentleman from the 8th. Mr. Garland Penholzer states that he has a conflict of interest and asked to be excused from voting. The chair so recognizes that. Gentleman from the 35th, what purpose does the gentleman rise?
To inquire.
State your point.
What is those conflict of interest consist of?
Gentleman did not state, but I guess that's his privilege. Under the rules of the House, he has that right.
You're enlightened.
Just simply a vast conflict of interest.
Well, both of them look rather wealthy. So.
Okay.
On the Dover Amendment, which has been printed and passed out on your desk, any objection dispense with the reading of the Dover Amendment and others, Dover and others. Chair has none, we've dispensed with the reading of the Dover Amendment. Any objection adopting the Dover Amendment? Chair has none, the Dover Amendment's adopted.
Committee sub as amended.
Any objection adopting the committee substitute as amended? Chair has none, the committee substitute's adopted. Any objection report to committee which is favorable to pass the bill? Chair, none of them is agreed to. Shall this bill now pass? All those in favor, vote aye. Opposed, no. Clerk will unlock the machine. This is the main bill, ladies and gentlemen. All members voted. All members now voted. Clerk will.
Grace hadn't voted.
All members now voted. Clerk will. Lock the machine. Pass the bill. The ayes are 139, the nays are 24. This bill having received the requisite county majority is therefore passed.
Chair recognizes gentleman 99th, Mr. Groover.
Mr. Speaker, I move this House to deny adjourn until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Doorkeepers, close the doors and keep them closed. Ladies and gentlemen of the House, I want to tell you now, you all need to remember, you got to go to Rules Committee in the morning if you want to get a bill on the calendar. You don't need to come up here and see me unless it's on the Rules Committee calendar. You understand that? I'm going to let Mr. Lee get to you in just a minute, Mr. Redden. I just want you to know you got to face him in the morning if you want a bill called. Now, you've been beating on me all year. Now you beat on him from here on in. Yeah. All right, Mr. Lee.
Where are we now? Just had the motion. Now you got to read all these parliamentary inquiries.
What purpose of the gentleman's 50s rise?
A parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Speaker.
The gentleman state his point.
Mr. Speaker, is it not true that if we accept a gentleman from the 99th Amendment, that those of us that have bills that are presently on the calendar today will be forced and have no choice than to face in the morning early in the a.m. the smiling face of a gentleman from the 72nd?
The legislative process will continue to function on tomorrow.
Further inquiry, Mr. Speaker.
State your point.
Is it not further true that maybe we should be allowed to work a little bit longer so that we would not have to burden the gentleman from the 72nd and the Distinguished Rules Committee with those minor bits of legislative proposition that we may have before this House at this particular time?
There's 106 people of this august body has more important things to do in their districts, around the town, and I think most of them is going to want to adjourn at this particular time. It's been a rather extremely long day.
Last inquiry, Mr. Speaker.
I hope it is the last one.
Is it not true that are you telling me that you would much rather have me address my legislative proposition to you than to this distinguished body this afternoon?
Whatever you think's fair. All right. Have we had read the notices?
No.
Clerk will please read the notices.
State Institutions and Property, Surplus Property Subcommittee, 8:30 in the morning. Judiciary will not meet today. The House Education Committee will not meet today. The meeting of the Motor Vehicle Insurance Subcommittee will be rescheduled at a later date. Reapportionment Committee meeting scheduled for tomorrow morning has been canceled. Rules, 9 o'clock in the morning. A meeting of the Defense and Veterans Affairs Committee will be held Thursday, February the 14th, 1991 at 2:30. This is to notify you there will be a meeting of the Interstate Highway System Subcommittee in Legislative Office Building Room, 605, Wednesday, February the 13th, 2:30 p.m. University System will not meet today, will not meet tomorrow. State Institution and Property, 9 o'clock, room 216, tomorrow. John White Subcommittee on Libraries will meet at 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, room 505, Legislative Office Building, through the notices.
Ladies and gentlemen of the House, it's been a long day. You've been very patient. You've been very attentive. We've addressed some important matters here today, and I want to commend you for that. The question now before us, shall this House now adjourn until 10 o'clock
tomorrow morning. All those in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, a like sign.
No.
The ayes clearly have it. We stand adjourned till 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All members, please take seats and cease all the conversation. Call the roll. Gentlemen, 99, Mr. Groover asks unanimous consent call the roll be dispensed with. Is there objection? Hear none, it's so ordered. Doorkeepers, close the doors and keep them closed. You know, it's always amazing to me when we don't have to call a roll, there are always two or three that slip out that need it just as bad as I do. Our chaplain of the day will be introduced by Mr. Snow of the First. Mr. Groover, you will start us on the Pledge of Allegiance after the prayer again, please, sir. Scripture reading and prayer by the chaplain.
Ladies and gentlemen of the House, Reverend Larry H. Summerhour is our chaplain today. He is my minister of the Chickamauga Elizabeth Lee United Methodist Church, and we're proud to have him with us today. He was accompanied by my local undertaker, Mr. Danny Wallace. I think some of my constituents told Danny that they would give me a free funeral, is that right, one day? But anyway, we're proud to have them here with us today. Danny, stand up here. He's a big fella. He's a good fella. Appreciate him driving the preacher down today, but I hope they make it, take him safely home this afternoon. Danny introduced him to Nikki Meadows and Beverly Langford back in the back a while ago. I said, Danny, you think that the preacher ought to pray for the for us House members here today? And he said, after meeting some of these folks, he thought the preacher ought to pray for the future of the state of Georgia. But anyway, we're glad to have them here with us. The Reverend Summerhour is, he was raised in Marietta, Georgia. Of course, he has his lovely wife and three children. He graduated from Reinhardt College up in North Georgia, the University of Georgia, Emory College on Seminary, and he's been our preacher up in Chickamauga for, I think, the last four years now. And I'll present to you the Reverend Larry Summerhour.
Thank you, Mike. This morning I want to share some scripture with you concerning God's unconditional love for us. You know, one of the things that I'm most thankful for is that God loves sinners. Amen? I'm thankful that God loves sinners. And I'm going to read this from Luke chapter 15 about the prodigal or the profligate son.
Jesus went on to say, there was once a man who had two sons. The younger one said to him, Father, give me my share of the property now. So the man divided his property between his two sons. After a few days, the younger son sold his part of the property and left home with the money. He went to a country far, far away, where he wasted his money in reckless living. He spent everything he had, then a severe famine spread over the country, and he was left without a thing. So he went to work for one of the citizens of that country, who sent him out to his farm to take care of the pigs. Now here's a young Jewish man who has rebelled against his father, who has left home and says, Father, I want nothing to do with you anymore. And he winds up, a young Jewish man, feeding the pigs, which was the worst thing you could do. And Luke pretty well tells us that this young man had literally stooped to the bottom of the barrel. Verse 16, he wished he could fill himself with the bean pods the pigs ate, but no one gave him anything to eat. At last he came to his senses and he said, all my father's hired workers, all of them have more than they can eat. And here I am about to starve. I will get up and I will go to my father and I will say to my father, Father, I have sinned against God and against you. Treat me as one of your hired workers. So he got up and started back to his father. Now, what is the father's response to this? What is the father's response? Here this young man has rebelled against the father. He has sinned against the father. He's not what you would call a lovable son. But what is the father's response? Listen, he was still a long way from home when his father saw him. His heart was filled with pity, and he ran and threw his arms around his son, and he kissed him. Boy, I like that, don't you? The son said, Father, I have sinned against you and against God. I am no longer fit to be called your son. But this is what the father does in verse 22. Listen to this. But the father called to his servants, hurry, he said, hurry. Bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger, shoes on his feet. Then go and get the prize calf and kill it. For this son of mine was dead, but now he is alive. He was lost, but now he has been found. I believe with all my heart, not only Mr. Speaker, but all of you, that there's only one perfect person who's ever lived on the face of this earth, and that was Jesus Christ. I believe that. I tell people wherever I go that if they're looking for a perfect preacher, then I'm not the one. You know, preachers sometimes, somebody asked me the hardest thing about being a preacher. Sometimes we expect preachers to be perfect. Sometimes we expect them to, then they're not perfect. And if we're honest with ourselves today, we've all sinned and come short. Aren't you thankful that God loves us? I know when the world seems to be against us, and preachers are kind of like politicians, you're not going to please all the people all the time. You're always going to have somebody that doesn't like something. But there's one thing that when I go to bed at night, I can be sure of. I can't be sure of a lot of things in this world, but I know, Mr. Speaker and members of this body, I know that God loves me. And I'm going to tell you, friend, I sleep good at night. And I know that if I died, I'd go to heaven. I know that. Somebody said, don't you doubt it? No, I don't doubt that. Because I know that God loves me. I want you to stand. Let us have a prayer, please. I want us to thank God in our prayer for his love. Father, we're so thankful for the speaker and these fine members. And Father, today we just especially thank you that you love sinners. We thank you that you love the unlovable, that you love us even when we sin. You hate sin, but you love the sinner. Father, we thank you for that. We ask thy blessings upon the speaker and all these members today. Father, give them guidance is my prayer. In Jesus' precious name we pray. Amen and amen.
Let us pledge allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
Doorkeepers open doors, checking out gentleman 108. Speaker, your committee on journals read proceedings of the previous legislative day and find them to be correct. Chairman, committee adjourned, report committee to read the journal of yesterday and found to be correct. Any objection dispense with the reading of the journal? Chair none reading the journal dispense with. Any objection confirmation of the journal? Chair none, journal is confirmed. Clerk will read the resolution established order of business today.
Mr. Walker, the 115th, moves that the following be established as the order of business during the first part of the period of unanimous consent. 1. Introduction of bills and resolutions. 2. First reading and reference of House bills and resolutions. 3. Second reading of bills and resolutions. 4. Reports of standing committees. 5. Third reading and passage of local uncontested bills. 6. First reading and reference of Senate bills and resolutions. 7. That the Speaker may, in his discretion, call up any bill on the general calendar in any order that he may desire.
Any objection adopting the resolution stands to order business for the day? Chair none, resolution stands to order business for the day is adopted. Introduction of bill and resolutions. All members having bill and resolution, please bring the clerk's desk. First reading assignment of bill and resolutions. Clerk will read.
House Bill 677, to amend Article 1, relating to general provisions regarding specific business and occupation taxes.
Ways and Means.
678, to amend Title 21, relating to ethics in government.
Government Affairs.
House Bill 679, to amend Section 15, relating to the powers and duties of the Prosecuting Attorney's Counsel.
Judiciary.
680, to amend Section 15, relating to a request for the assistance of a senior judge.
Judiciary.
681, a bill to be entitled in act, amend Code Section 51, relating to liability of volunteer health care providers.
Health and Ecology.
House Bill 682, creating State Court of Chattoog County.
State Plan Community Affairs.
683, to amend Chapter 11, relating to juvenile proceedings.
Judiciary.
684, creating and establishing the Recorder's Court of DeKalb County.
State Plan Community Affairs.
685, creating the State Court, Decatur County.
State Plan Community Affairs.
686, creating a new charter, City of Fairmount.
State Plan Community Affairs.
687, to amend Article 15, relating to serious traffic offenses.
Judiciary.
688, amend the act creating the Rome Floyd County Commission.
State Plan Community Affairs.
689, amend Title 37, relating to administration of mental health.
Health and Ecology.
690, amend Title 31, relating to control of venereal diseases.
Health and Ecology.
691, amend Section 48, relating to Georgia taxable net income.
Ways and Means.
692, amend Article 1, relating to child custody in general.
Special duty.
House Bill 693, to amend Title 36, relating to general provisions applicable to counties.
Industry.
House Bill 694, to amend Chapter 5, relating to crimes against the person.
Special duty.
House Bill 695, to amend Article 7, relating to scholarships, loans, and grants, so as to authorize the Georgia Student Finance Commission to promote purposes, expend such purposes.
University System of Georgia.
Resolution 283, redesignating a portion of the Appalachian Highway, State Route 515, as the Zell Miller Mountain Parkway.
Transportation.
284, urging department and agencies of the state of Georgia to assist in rural development.
State Plan Community Affairs.
This is an add-on.
A resolution creating the Airports Study Committee.
Transportation.
Through the first readers.
Second reading of the bill and resolution.
House Bill 661, a bill relating to five-year and annual license plates. House Bill 663, a bill to provide for the determination of the mileage rate by the governing authorities of Gwinnett County. House Bill 668, a bill relating to returns of residents for ad valorem taxation. House Bill 671, a bill relating to the application of uniform rules of the road to highways and exceptions to such requirements. House Bill 674, a bill relating to the authority to acquire property for public road and other transportation purposes. House Bill 676, a bill relating to Sunday sales on farm wineries. House Resolution 260, a resolution proposing an amendment to the Constitution so as to provide for the establishment of special judicial circuits. House Bill 261, a resolution urging the United States Congress to open the cable industry to more competition in the marketplace. Senate Bill 95, a bill relating to housing in general so as to delete the provisions relating to the Georgia Residential Finance Authority and thereby abolish the Georgia Residential Finance Authority. Senate Bill 241, a bill to provide that vehicles shall be registered and licensed to operate for the ensuing calendar year and thereafter in Miller County during the designated registration periods as provided. Through the second readers.
Reports to standing committees.
Mr. Lane of the 27th, Chairman of the Committee on State Planning and Community Affairs, submitted the following report. Your Committee on State Planning and Community Affairs has had under consideration the following bill to the House and has instructed me to report the same back to the House with the following recommendations. House Bill 647, 655, do pass. Respectfully submitted, Mr. Lane, Chairman. Mr. Buck of the 95th, Chairman of the Committee on University System, submitted the following report. Mr. Speaker, your Committee on University System of Georgia has had under consideration the following resolution of the House and has instructed me to report the same back to the House with the following recommendations. Resolution 225, do pass. Respectfully submitted, Mr. Buck, Chairman. Through the committee reports.
Third reading and passage of local bills and resolutions. I don't have a local calendar.
Yes, sir, you've got one back there.
You all have a copy of the local calendar. If any of you desire either of the local bills to be taken out and vote on individually, otherwise we'll vote on it as a unit. Clerk will lead the local calendar.
House Bill 647, to provide for one or more community improvement districts, Douglas County. House Bill 655, create the City of DeKalb Study Commission.
Anyone desiring the local bill to be taken out and voted on individually, hear no request, we'll vote on a local calendar unit. Is any objection to previous question being ordered on the local calendar? Chair, none to previous question ordered. Any objection to read the Board of Committee's favor, pass the bill on the local calendar? Chair, none, Board of Committee agreed to, shall lead the local bill now pass. All in favor, rise, stand, or you're counted. Reverse your positions. Passes the bill, ayes are. Set 97, the nays are 4. These bills have received the requisite constitutional majority, therefore pass. On yesterday, all members, please take seats and cease our conversation. We are now ready to undertake the general calendar. All members, please take seats and cease our conversation. All members, please take seats and cease all conversation. On yesterday, we had under consideration House Bill 376, which failed to receive a constituted majority, and there was a notice of reconsideration was given, chairing out the lady from the 30th.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the House reconsider its action yesterday in failing to give House Bill 376, as amended, a constitutional majority.
Clerk will read the caption.
House Bill 376, a bill to be entitled an act amend Article 2, relating to offenses against public order so as to prohibit certain conduct based on the status of a person, to provide for definitions, to provide that certain conduct shall be a misdemeanor of a high and aggravated nature.
Lady from the 30th.
Parliamentary inquiry, Mr. Speaker.
Lady, state your point.
Is it not true that this bill, as amended yesterday on the floor, describes status simply as race, religion, sex, color, and national origin?
The lady so states.
Further inquiry, Mr. Speaker.
Lady, state her point.
Is it not true that if the House votes this morning to reconsider this bill, that what will happen simply is that this bill will be sent and placed in the bosom of the Rules Committee?
Lady is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.